Hello and welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
That's why we read plays instead.
Right, yeah. We decided to read a play instead of a book.
Because we hate books.
I hate books.
And we only like plays now.
I want more Irish in my life, and since Irish people don't write books...
That's very true. It's a well-known fact that Irish people do not write books.
No one's ever heard of an Irish writer before.
No. They only write plays. Martin McDonagh is the only Irish writer in history.
He's the only literate Irishman.
Yeah. That's why we decided to read The Beauty Queen of Lennon this week.
Also, our apologies to any Irish people who just heard that. None of that is true.
Okay, I guess James Joyce, but he doesn't really count because he's weird. Because he, like, pooped too much. Seriously, look up James Joyce's love letters and then giggle at the poop. Anyway. This week we read The Beauty Queen of Lennon by Martin McDonagh.
By Martin McDonagh.
He is Irish.
He is Irish, much like we are not.
Aye, brother. It's true. I believe I heard a tale from my own playwriting professor that The Beauty Queen of Lennon was the first play that he ever wrote, and he, like, read a book on how to structure a play and then sat down and wrote this play.
Crazy if true, by the way.
And that makes me just want to punch him right in his face. Because it's so good!
It is so good.
And my first play was like, burp, burp, burp. My playwriting professor's like, hey, where's your plot? And I was like, burp, 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 burp. So, yeah, about that. I guess we'll go ahead and institute a spoiler policy. The play is written a while ago, but there is some twists in there.
Yeah, and most of our audience, I know, doesn't really read plays.
Yeah.
So if you want to read this one, then hit the pause button for about an hour, read the play, and come back.
Yeah, and it won't take you long.
I think I read the first half of it while Erica was making coffee this morning.
Yeah, really, like, it won't take you, you know, less than an hour, like, doubt, but, well, it might take you less than an hour.
It's pretty short.
It is pretty short. Spoiler alert, we will spoil the play. And if you don't turn off the podcast, that's too bad, because Marine totally tortures her mother by pouring hot wax onto her hand.
Yeah, and then murders the shit out of her.
Yeah, and then hits her in the head with a fireplace poker, so that's pretty awesome. In addition to all the excitement of reading a play or whatever... we have a guest this week.
We do. Oh, is that why we have this extra person in our, well, studio is too strong of a word, but...
He was going to do air quotes, and then he realized that you cannot see
This it. Is not a visual medium. This is not a play?
This is not a play. But this is a play. And I'm pointing, and you can't see. Tricksy hobbits. So this week... we have joining us our cousin, Sarah.
Yo, yo.
That was her.
Hi, cousin Sarah.
Hi, I'm your cousin Sarah.
That's her only defining characteristic. No, she, you are actually majoring in playwriting, is that?
That is a fact. I'm an expert.
Yeah, so, we decided to read a play in honor.
That's right.
Of her.
We can let her choose the play, unless Gabs chose the play.
I'm pretty sure I chose the play.
Okay, we didn't let her choose the play.
But I knew that she had read it before, which is why I chose it.
Okay.
And then I totally dig it.
Yeah.
So
I did have Sarah in mind.
Fair enough.
But it really is.
Which is close to letting me have my own will and effect on the universe, but not quite the same thing.
I think it's the same thing. Yeah, be quiet and agree with me.
Yes. You'll be happy as an extension of Gabs' will. Now off with you.
We're not talking about plays anymore, guys.
So I guess What is the genre of this play?
Is play a genre?
I think we had this conversation with Shakespeare. I'm pretty sure
we did.
Decided no, play is not a genre.
Psychological drama?
Psychological drama. I think I can go with that.
I think the genre is just Irish.
It's a good starting point. Is Irish a genre?
That's actually my plot synopsis. Ireland.
Ireland.
Potatoes.
Let's shorten it. Let's see if we can trim that just to ire.
Ire. There was a lot of ire going on.
That's a good description of the play. I'd say psychological drama is, yes, probably a pretty good description.
I think that's fair, especially with a final scene that makes you question everything you just read.
Yeah, makes you be like, what?
What actually happened? Which is why the spoiler alert thing is important, because a lot of the pleasure of reading this play is the different directions that you don't expect to be taken.
Yeah, the new things that get revealed that make you think certain characters are or are not credible.
Like, you totally think Maureen is a basically cool dude most of the way, because, you know, she's just doing her thing.
She's being put upon by her mother.
Yeah, her overbearing, psychotic, senile mother. But turns out she's psychotic, too.
It might actually be partly her mother's fault, but she's... Yeah, kind of her own horrible person, so we'll get into that in a moment.
That is a staple of Martin McDonagh. Everyone is a horrible person.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they live in Ireland, right?
No.
I don't actually hate Ireland. I don't know why I'm insisting on being so rude.
We're so careful not to do that to people.
And I'm like, we accept everybody but Ireland.
We'll take on the Irish. They're white. They can handle it, right?
Yeah, even though they are like the black men of Europe.
Well.
Kind of. That was probably a poor comparison.
I've actually heard that said before, though.
It's not like I'm writing a play about Ireland or anything. I totally hate them.
Well, when we read James Joyce, we had, you know, a student copy with context in the back. And they did have political cartoons that people in England drew about Irish people.
Mm-hmm.
And the caricature of the Irish person is basically the same as, like, racist America's caricature of black people.
I see.
Because it's like the simian face features. And I was looking
backwards
at it like,
what?
And
patties.
Yeah.
And that idea was present in the play, too.
Yes, definitely.
Going to England or America to actually have employment. And how they were not treated very well when they were over there.
Especially in England.
Especially in England.
Which, given that Ireland and England have been in this imperialistic and independence struggle for centuries, makes sense.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
Why can I not say Ireland all of a sudden? Ireland.
I thought you were trying to say I learned.
I learned.
I learned Ireland.
They didn't become independent until 1900s, right?
Yeah. So. 1921.
Yeah.
And they are a free state of the United Kingdom.
Okay, so they're still not...
They're the same as Australia and Canada, I believe.
I thought Canada was...
More independent?
Yeah.
They're similar, comparable.
And according to Ben, Germany owns, like, most of Ireland anyways.
Yeah, that was a chapter in the book Boomerang, that when the... economy of various nations are going down the crapper. Ireland was one of the hardest hit, and basically most of their toxic assets were bought up by Germans. So something like 80% of the land in Ireland is German owned right now, I think.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's pretty messed up. Shall we move on from there?
Sure, why not?
Plot synopsis.
Crazy people be crazy.
That bitches is, be crazy.
Yeah.
Or just me comp plan is lumpy.
That's exactly all that happens in this entire play.
Yeah, lead it to our port on your head.
Which I would not put past her. I actually looked up comp plan because I didn't know what the fuck it was.
I thought it was tea, and then when they said chicken flavor, I realized it must have been broth or something.
It's a shake, kind of. They said it's like a like a diet shake. It's kind of like what the hell am I thinking of? Those Nutrisystem shake
things.
Yeah.
You know? It's kind of like that, but they're gross flavors.
It's like, and here's 200 calories of protein, basically.
Yeah. And you drink them when you're trying to, you know, put on muscle, probably, or when you're older and can't necessarily chew, stuff like that, so you get all your stiff still.
Because all Mags eats is porridge, Compline, and
cod and butter sauce.
Biscuits.
Because Maureen mentions cod and butter sauce.
Yeah.
But who knows if she actually lets Mag eat it.
So, plot synopsis. We've got a mother and a daughter pair living together in this small little county of Ireland. Am I supposed
to? Yeah, go ahead. You got it.
I'm going to say things. Maybe they'll make sense. And they've kind of been mutually torturing each other because Mags is supposed to, air quotes that you can't see, take care of Maureen after she gets out of a mental institution for a breakdown she had.
Right.
And
which you don't find out till later.
Yes. Spoiler. Anyway, Maureen is kind of the caretaker of Mags, but they are just slewing hatred at each other.
Yep.
And Maureen is a virgin and wants to escape from her mother.
She's 40, so
yeah,
she's probably ready to go get some.
She's
It's a vitriolic relationship that Maureen wants to escape.
And it decays until she does escape it.
By murdering her.
By
mother.
Murdering her, involving a miscommunication that in Shakespeare would probably be presented as hilarious instead of poisonous.
Or in a romantic comedy.
Yeah. Right.
In a romantic comedy, she actually would have made it to the train station before Peta left, and then they were all going, oh,
her. Maureen takes up with this dude, Peta Dooley, who she's been interested in, and they don't have sex.
Because they try to have
they
sex.
Try. Doesn't work out.
That's another plot twist.
Yeah. And he goes to work in England, but ends up writing back to Maureen to ask her to come to America with him. And Mags destroys the letter. Mag destroys the letter so Maureen never knows. And in the play, originally we think that Maureen managed to catch Peta before he leaves for America, and they plan to meet up in America in a month or so, but in actuality, we discover that Maureen never reached Peto. He left and ended up getting engaged to a girl in America, and
Maureen is stuck at home.
After having killed her mother.
Yep.
So that she can leave with Peto.
Yep.
Yep.
Moral poker. Back
so,
yes.
Happy ending all around.
Moral of the story, don't trust your little brother to deliver messages.
Yeah, right? Yeah, if I ever have something really important to send, I'm going to be like, Caleb, not giving it to you.
In her hand, put it.
In her hand, put
That's
it.
That's why you seal it in an envelope and hand it to a professional courier.
Right.
Yeah. Pedro sends his little brother Ray to send all of his messages to Maureen, and it never gets to her.
Yeah.
Ray is always impatient and tells Mag, or gives the letter to Mag.
I mean, to be fair to Ray...
Oh, yeah.
He does have to put up with some pretty crazy nonsense.
Ray probably shouldn't have to put up with what he puts up with. Also,
fact.
I think Ray might make 3/4 of this cast crazy.
Yes.
I'm not sure he's all that mentally stable himself.
No.
He's like, man,
if you read the successive plays, you get to hear some more crazy shit about him.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Okay, then.
Yeah, this is part of, not a trilogy per se, but a part of, there are many, a couple companion plays that take place in the same location with characters that reference each other in all of them. So, like,
so it's a little bit of like the Faulknerian thing, where Percy, what's his name, I think, is in various stories.
Yeah, although like Father Welsh shows up in one of the plays.
They always refer to Father Welsh.
And they talk about Maureen in the other play, so you don't get to actually see her.
Okay.
So.
And in this play, they talk about these two brothers who are just awful to each other, and then The Lonesome West is about them.
Hmm. He's Stephen King-ing it up.
Yeah. There you go.
So, in case you couldn't tell, setting is Ireland, definitely post-1960s because they have a picture of JFK on the wall, and I guess we don't know exactly time period, but there are planes and and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends how undeveloped rural Ireland is, because I would be willing to believe it happened yesterday.
Yeah.
And I would be equally willing to believe it was 50 years ago.
Yeah.
But it probably wasn't much longer ago than that.
No, like I said, they have pictured JFK.
Right, yeah,
involved.
Yeah.
So it has to be post JFK.
That's true.
And then Point of View Tense, obviously, it's a play, so, you know, there's that.
Yeah. So you see things on stage.
As we move into talking about the characters, since we were, like, trying to do that anyway.
Yeah.
So, our protagonist.
Is Maureen.
Maureen?
Maureen.
40-year-old virgin.
Yeah, she's a...
Irish style.
She stars in that Steve Carell movie.
That's right. That's actually... It was an adaptation of this play. Oh my
God. The worst adaptation of this play ever.
Just threw everything out and started from scratch.
It's not going to be set in Ireland. It's not going to star a woman.
And like Ireland.
Yeah, so Maureen's the protagonist. Like Sarah said, she's stuck at home taking care of her aging, crazy mother. And again, we're using crazy in the context of these people probably all belong in mental institutions. Not like they're crazy.
Well, look at their off the wall antics of Mags and Maureen. They're like the odd couple, but in Ireland. Ba-doop, 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 ba-doop.
So at the beginning, all we know is that Maureen is putting up with her mom, who's pretty obnoxious.
I'd say the first couple scenes, you definitely think that Mags is becoming senile, but also kind of bitter, vindictive.
Yeah.
Manipulative. Yeah. She gets Maureen to do everything for her and convinces her there is no other out for her.
Like, right.
No men will have her, and
whereas
that's all she has.
Early on, Maureen seems more sympathetic and put upon, and like, she's mad. She's angry at her mother, but it
she's
seems deserved.
She's rude, but yeah, it seems justified.
Yeah.
I mean, she just had that one speech about murdering her mom, which is kind
well,
of rude at the beginning.
Right.
But
that was pretty over the top.
Does kind of feel just like an outburst, though.
Yeah, it does. I agree.
Mm-hmm, not like a serious plan.
But it also does kind of lay a seed.
Yeah.
Of
which is wonderful. Brilliant.
Yeah. Right.
And, I mean, the main thing about Maureen is, you know, she is trying to get out of the situation, and ultimately she turns into her mother.
Yeah, she pretty much literally does.
In the first scene that Ray, Pato's little brother, comes to Mag to give a message for Maureen, the things that Mag says, that he complains about her being a loon, she repeats the same thing, she keeps getting his name wrong, and then in a final scene, Maureen does the same thing to Ray, repeating his name, getting things wrong,
and
making him do stuff for her.
How she starts the scene okay, and then once she figures out that her whole daydream about finding Pato was wrong, and it didn't actually happen, she just immediately has, like, a psychotic break and turns into Mag.
Yeah. Though it kind of also makes me kind of wonder if Mag was actually becoming senile, or if she also had some mental confusion and illness like her daughter.
Yeah. That wouldn't surprise me.
It wouldn't surprise me either. Those sorts of things certainly do tend to run in families.
There's just a bleak desperation throughout that these characters are just grasping and grasping and grasping.
And never get it.
Catch anything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Maureen almost catches something with Pato and can't take coming back from that.
Yeah.
Damn it, Ray.
I know, right?
God damn it, Ray Dooley.
Damn little kidding. Brothers. Ray, that should be the real plot synopsis, is little brothers suck.
Little brothers ruin everything.
Take that, Caleb.
Yeah. He was doing a favor in the first place, so I guess he's not that bad.
Well, he tried, but
yeah,
he failed.
He couldn't take the madness of Mag for that long.
Yeah.
The madness of Mag.
Yes.
Well, do you want to talk about Ray a little bit more?
Since we're here?
Yeah.
Why not?
He's about the television.
Well, yeah.
And hitting police.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, there was a good scene where he's talking about how Marine stole his ball.
Yeah.
He had some kind of, like, batting set. Yeah, and the ball rolled into the yard and she took it. And Mag says, well, I thought you were pelting the ball at our chickens and killing them. And then he says, no, it just flew off and she took it and wouldn't give it back. And you're not really sure if he's lying or if Marine was lying to
right.
Mag, which is the sort of situation that happens a lot in this play.
Yes.
Which I liked. And then Ray finds this fireplace poker that they have and starts talking about killing people
right.
with it, basically.
Wow, this would be a great murder weapon. Can I buy it from you?
Yeah.
With that intro? No!
And you're sitting there going, oh, okay, I thought Ray might have been the only sane one, but
turns out not.
Turns out no one.
So yeah, I would believe him throwing
He's
balls at chickens and trying to kill them.
Well, then he was talking about his broken toes he got from being in a fight that he got from kicking a door, apparently.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Someone else told me you broke those toes from kicking the door.
Yeah, so I didn't know if maybe he was just a young guy who was bragging about how awesome he was.
He seems
like,
a little full of it.
Fighting with the police, and like, no one can hold me down.
Yeah.
I'm so young and awesome.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe he was completely full of crap. But then, of course, as you've learned more about Maureen by the time that exchange happens, like, no, maybe she was the liar back with the ball story.
Uh-huh.
So, another staple of Martin McDonagh, everyone is nuts, it seems like. There doesn't seem to be a mentally stable character in any of his plays that I've read.
Well, let's talk about Pato, then, because
Pato
might
be.
Seems mentally stable to me.
He seemed like
he was the least.
Yeah, he and Maureen, I think, kind of liked each other maybe all the way back to their school days a little bit. And had a little bit of a thing. And they kind of had reconnected at this event. And he was even inviting her to move to America with him.
Yeah, after like one night together.
And sounded pretty sincere in like the letter he wrote.
Yeah.
And he was saying, no, I actually did have a good time, and I really do like you, and, you know, I think you just you misinterpreted the thing I said, and of course I didn't think you looked bad. I would like to see you that way again.
Yeah,
and
he does make that's a good
because he, when she's walking around in her bra and slip to kind of throw it in Mag's face that she's got a fella now, Pato tells her to put some clothes on because it's cold, and she thought it was like, oh, I'm ugly and you hate me.
Yeah.
Right.
Which I guess if you're 40 years old and you've, like, never really had a boyfriend before, it'd be easy to
well, and if you've ever
listen and internalize that.
Yeah.
If you've ever talked to somebody who's in the midst of an anxiety attack of some sort, then that's the sort of thing that happens in those exchanges, too.
Yeah,
where
I believe it.
Someone will hear everything as a criticism,
mm-hmm.
or they'll hear what they in their head, whatever thing they think is wrong with them in that moment is everything they hear, and they don't actually hear the words you say.
Fact.
And I think that's exactly what was happening in that scene.
Well, the other thing about Pato is that in that scene, he's dealing with Maureen and Mag being horrible to each other and being really awkward, but then he takes it really well. Because he's still interested in Maureen, even though he just witnessed all of that.
Yeah.
Right.
And found out that she was in a mental hospital at one point for, like, a breakdown that she had, and still seems interested. Whereas, like, if Ray had been there, he would have just been yelling, feck at everybody.
Yeah.
He'd have been out.
Yeah.
And in that scene, a couple more other important things happen, such as Mag is being generally really horrible to Maureen because Maureen's like, oh, look at this man that I just had sex with, and really flaunting that.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mag starts to kind of demean the character of Maureen, saying she'd been to this mental institute, saying that she had held Mag's hand down on the range and poured hot oil over it to scald it. And at the time, we think that that's just Mac's invention because she's grasping at straws to try to...
she's so pissed at Maureen.
Make
right.
Maureen seem... to put Peyto off of Maureen.
Right. And then Maureen brings up the point, yeah, well, you pour your pee in the sink every morning. So they're, like, constantly trying to discredit the other person's version of
events. And at that point, we
events.
Kind of agree with... or we believe Maureen because Mac just seems to be... trying to.
Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
we have witnessed her pour pee in the sink, and
yeah.
we have witnessed her try not to tell Maureen about the party,
right.
and insulting her wearing a dress and all this stuff. And
yeah, and there's kind of an overbearing mother archetype that
yeah.
exists in, you know, novels, movies, plays, whatever, of the manipulative mother who is quite frequently, like, super... moralistic controlling, where
mm-hmm.
she wouldn't want the daughter to go to a dance or wear a fashionable dress that
yeah.
she'd consider to be too short or whatever, and
go
hang out with guys.
With
right? She's like, I'm 40. I think I can gallivant with a fella or two.
And she has two sisters who are married, and she said, "How do you think they found husbands if they didn't go off gallivanting?"
Right.
Fellas.
I can only assume those other sisters had it together enough to be able to get the hell out of the house and get a job.
Yeah, I
or
think
maybe they did get the hell out, and that's why they keep it together.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I was thinking, is they said, oh god, one of us is going to be stuck here. Let's get out as fast as possible.
Peace.
Hurry, get married, and run. Because it seems like that's kind of what you have to do, is get married
mm-hmm.
to run away. Which I think... can bring us to some moral issues and talk about feminism, because you do have a little bit of the old-fashioned Maureen can't really go out on her own thing,
mm-hmm.
and she'll need to rely on Peyto to get her out of there.
Right.
Yeah, the only way out for her is through a man.
Mm-hmm.
And her sisters are out of there because they're married.
Uh-huh. Although, it was nice to have a main female character, and the two female characters are basically
the
majority of the play.
The action, yeah.
Right.
And I was kind of wondering, when we read Gone Girl, we were talking about whether Amy was bad for feminism because she was so crazy.
Right.
And, like, is she just the crazy woman who's, you know, running around? And when I was reading this play, I was thinking, could you try and make the argument that, you know, Mag is the archetype of the overbearing mother, and Maureen's just, like, the crazy girl who...
Yeah, though I feel like these two are almost more believably crazy. Like, the psychology in this play was
yeah.
far Very more interesting well. To me than in Gone Girl.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, the argument I was going to make is that I don't think so, because even though on the surface they are, the other characters don't seem... even the characters you don't get to meet that they just talk about don't seem wholly
Same.
Together.
Right.
Like, I feel like McDonough's not saying, look at these crazy women, and that's the play. It's more like, look at how this situation.
Town.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
How Ireland. Yeah, and the situation of Ireland
mm-hmm.
is making them
desperate.
Right. And crazy. I was actually gonna make a kind of similar point about the feminist angle, too, that it almost feels like more of a byproduct of the setting, like the craziness or the fact that women are kind of in this certain role. It felt like it's because they're in this place more than because of that's how things are, according to Martin McDonagh, you know?
It doesn't seem like he's saying that it should be that these women can only
though,
escape through men.
The opposite of that, if anything, because if Maureen could just pick up and move and take care of herself, things would have been much better than any other scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And that's made... I think that's made pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she's... she is, on some levels, an empowered woman, because she's like, I can have sex with whomever I please.
Yeah.
She's trying
to make some of those arguments.
She's not given the opportunity
mm-hmm.
to a lot of the time, but she's like... She's empowered to have sex with Peyto, and... if she were to go with him, she said, be it married or living in sin, I don't care.
Right, yeah. And that was kind of, maybe it's part of why she was flaunting it, too, to say,
mm-hmm.
look, Mom, this is the new way of doing
mm-hmm.
things.
I'm a new woman.
This is what women should be able to do. And so she's kind of like, I don't know, almost trying to make some of those arguments without really having the academic language for it that has been developed.
Yeah. And I liked that, actually. I was like, you go, girl. And then Peyto's like, sorry, I couldn't get it up. I was too drunk. And I was like, no!
No!
Damn it, Peyto!
Like, poor Marine. I want her to not have to be a virgin anymore.
Yeah, that totally sucks.
Though then when she committed murder, I was less concerned for her sexual health.
Let's worry about that.
Well, maybe if she'd had a healthy understanding of her sexuality, she wouldn't have killed another.
Yeah.
Who knows? So you see, I think that actually ties in with the morality of this play too, because it's, I don't think it's a murder that is fully justifiable, but I think the I think the psychology is set up so you can see how it happened. You're just, it's not, you're not so much supposed to see it as, oh, she had no other choice, but you are definitely supposed to see it as, I see how she came to this point.
She thought she had no other choice.
Yeah, I think she thought that was the only way for her to get out, because she wasn't...
Because otherwise she's fantasized about killing her mother.
True.
She never did it until her mother stood directly as an obstacle to an attainable escape.
Right. Though I will say that she never saw just abandoning her mother as an option, but she saw killing her as an option, which is kind of interesting to me. Yeah.
Yeah, wouldn't put her in a home, but...
Well, she couldn't put her in a home because she didn't have enough money, they later stated.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, I don't remember that.
Peyto sounded like he was willing to find a way to try to pay for it, though.
Yeah.
To make it happen. But, I mean, she definitely was so tied to this place and to this woman that she saw no way of escaping her without her being dead.
Well, and her mom is... Mag is...
Utterly dependent.
Very... very much trying to keep her there.
Oh, yeah.
Like, in all of her power to keep her there, too. So, that doesn't help Maureen's stability.
Right.
And then another, in connection to that, and in connection to her inability to escape without a man, Maureen doesn't seem to have ever had an example of a woman who could be independent. Because Mag is utterly dependent on her, and... her sisters went off and got married, and that was how they escaped. So she doesn't see the option of being independent.
Right. And she's from this crazy backwater county where nobody probably behaves that way either.
Yeah.
Where apparently the water is full of green.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about issues of racism?
Yeah, I mean, it's racism, kind of like we were talking about at the very beginning of the podcast, where the Irish are looked down upon by the English. Definitely a couple of the direct quotations of things that were said to them come across as basically sounding racist.
Yeah, Maureen and Peyto and maybe even Ray all talk about going and working in England and... how everyone looks down on them, and
some of these quotes are, "You old backward Paddy feckin', the feckin' pig's backside face on you. Go back to that backward feckin' pigsty of yours, or whatever hole it was you drug yourself out of."
So, yay!
Yeah,
that's real nice.
That's pretty harsh, and it's a it's kind of a dynamic that I think in the United States is almost a little bit hard to understand, like the idea of white on white racism, I guess.
Even though we were pretty racist to white, to Irish people in the 1800s.
It was a thing here with the second wave immigration. And I don't know. I mean, I guess it's just anywhere where people are different. It tends to crop up.
Where those differences fall along, not necessarily warring parties, but parties in conflict. That's gonna hurt.
Well, England tried to dominate and take over Ireland for so much of history that they probably... Not talking to all English people, because I know you're not all racist. But if you... I see how you could inherently view yourself as superior, because you were like, we were in control of you guys for hundreds of years.
I'd say there's definitely an economic class element of it as well. Like, I think that certain forms of racism... today in the United States are politically acceptable with some people, if they make an economic argument rather than a color-based argument.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Like, if you say, oh, well, these poor people come up here and then drain our services and take our jobs, I think we pretty clearly know what I'm outlining here when I say that.
Yeah. I mean, no, I don't get it.
Yeah, right. But all these anti-immigrant folks, especially in the South and Southwest,
mm-hmm.
who would make those kinds of arguments, you know, without really any economic reality to support it. And it sounds like kind of a similar thing between the Irish and the English,
mm-hmm.
where here's a group of people who are poorer,
mm-hmm.
and who are in your country, and so you just think, oh, you come from this filthy place. And
they're your janitors and your
right, and you're doing all these low manual labor jobs, so you must be dumber than us too. Like, why would you be from a poor, dirty place if you were as good as we are?
Uh-huh.
And a lot of the conflict between the Protestants and the Catholics that, on a wider scale, would be the Irish nationalists and the British nationalists,
mm-hmm.
is that the Catholic working class are struggling to attain their equality, and the Protestant working class are trying to maintain what little they have, where it's like, we don't have a lot, and if you are allowed to come up to our level, we'll lose because you'll take from us. So mm-hmm. we have to maintain what little gap above you we've got by keeping you down.
And
so with the English fellow workers
mm-hmm.
that Maureen talks about, they might be trying to keep that a little bit above.
Sure, and that definitely fits into, like, the post-Civil War class economic ideas, racial ideas in the South, the United States as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, again, if you just want to draw parallels, since I know the vast majority of our listeners are in the United States, but the white, like, kind of the racism being
yeah.
encouraged because the poor white workers actually had a lot more in common with the poor former slaves
yeah.
than they did with the people in power.
With the wealthy white people, yeah.
Right, and so they were
struggling to maintain what little status they had.
Right,
yeah.
And so it helps them, they think at least, to keep one group below them all the time
mm-hmm.
for whatever reason.
Thus, unintentionally supporting a ruling class that doesn't take care of their own interests.
Well, and if you read people like Howard Zinn, then he thinks that the ruling class was intentionally manipulating those forces anyway.
Oh, if you took my history of the Old South class with my professor at Mizzou, we talked about that.
Well,
for
the same thing that's come up
I was going to say.
In my Northern Irish studies.
For the record, I'm inclined to agree with people like Howard Zinn. I'm just
that was a big topic of conversation.
I'm sure. Let's see, so
I guess...
Well, maybe, okay, one more moral issue, I think, for me at least, and that's the issue of mental illness.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so Mag is trying to use it to tar Maureen,
uh-huh.
and Pato says, you know, that's okay.
Nothing to be ashamed of.
People have breaks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then just... maybe how it was kind of inescapable when all was said and done.
Yeah. Oh, the mental illness aspect, you mean?
Yeah, or kind of the way, I guess more so how it affected the way that Maureen ended up treating her mother, because while her mother is psychologically torturing her, she is sometimes physically torturing her mother.
Yes.
And psychologically.
And yeah. psychologically, yeah.
But for all the flippant comments I've made, like, oh, with Martin McDonagh, everyone's nuts and everyone's a horrible person.
Mm-hmm.
It's... In a strange way, McDonagh treats mental illness and lack of moral fiber very compassionately. Like, you've got the explicit statement of Pato being like, it's okay to
mm-hmm.
have breakdowns, everybody has them. To the even the, like, they're awful to each other, but McDonagh still finds ways to get us to sympathize with them. And be like, you are awful to each other, and you are not all there, and that's a tragedy.
Yeah,
and there is... It's not inevitable. There are these ways for them to escape. Maureen had the option of Pato, and it just didn't work out.
Right.
And a lot of that was self-sabotage. Or because of the setup they'd already created between each other, it kept them grasping.
Right, and I mean, I agree that you... read the characters sympathetically because, I mean, like we were talking about the murder earlier, where it's not necessarily justified, but it's understandable.
It's a logical progression.
Right, exactly.
And you still feel bad for her, or for Meg when she gets her hand held on the range and hot oil poured.
Oh, well, certainly, yeah. Like, as bad as she's been, you don't want that to happen to her. Because
and you can start to go, oh, maybe she is kind of feeble and completely dependent on someone, and even though she's overbearing and a little horrible, now I... Oh, shit.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, them being interdependent was kind of a...
Yes.
Theme.
Theme, yes.
Yeah, for sure. I was just trying to segue us into themes.
Oh, be my guest.
And you then you gave us one, interdependency.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious that that is something going on here.
Yeah, because you have no way, there's almost no way out for Maureen psychologically.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even with Peyto, she's still having to kind of fight her way to that happening,
mm-hmm.
if that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's almost like you've two people with such problems that have anchored each other to each other that it's kind of like both of them are trying to stay afloat with a giant stone around their neck.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. That would be, I guess, the real theme in McDonough's work that I was trying to point out.
Mm.
And there's this one moment that after Peyto leaves... and Mag says, "You won't write at all, and I did throw your old dress in that dirty corner, too." There's just this one stage direction. Maureen looks at her a moment, sad, despairing, but not angry.
Mm-hmm.
And then she says, why do you, and trails off, but it's just like, and then she says, "Just look at yourself." It's a strange, quiet moment in the middle of all their vitriol.
Mm-hmm.
That's just... How did we get here?
Right. It's a moment of, like, it's a, I guess it's a, like, a violently emotional moment that is not presented violently, almost.
Yes. Which is
like, it's a really beautiful. Poignant sort of moment. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Instead of presenting it over the top, it's presented as just a reflective moment.
Well, this is a nice contrast because... One of the things Martin McDonagh is really known for is putting violence on stage.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so murders and whatever don't necessarily happen off
stage. Well, the stage direction said there was like a chunk of skullcap hanging from the poker.
I mean, there's...
That's pretty graphic.
Yeah, but then you can also... He's not just like writing violence so that everyone's shocked.
Right.
He has a good contrast in there.
And it's just, their entire relationship is a series of, I'm going to push, and I'm going to push harder, and I'm going to push back harder, and I'm going to push back harder in this escalation.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a break in that, because after Peyto leaves and Mag says that snarky thing, instead of shoving back even harder, he's just disengaging for a moment.
Yeah.
From that continuous grapple.
Would the idea of everyone kind of having a breaking point be a theme, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Well, I guess we never get to see if Peyto has a breaking point. Ray definitely does.
Ray does. Maureen does.
Maureen definitely does.
Mag
has a...
If she doesn't in the play, then she reached it a long time ago, and this is all post-breaking point.
That's
I might argue that.
I was about to argue for her. Yeah.
Where she's definitely committed to this. Do whatever it takes to keep Maureen and to keep Maureen demoralized enough to think that she needs Mag.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say something about, like, poverty breeds contempt. Some kind of theme along that line. Since we were just talking about the poor situation of County Ireland and...
Yeah, and I think poverty is... like a obviously present part of the setting, though not necessarily one that's really emphasized. It's just kind of obvious that that's their situation.
Which is interesting, because I feel like it is making a statement about this impoverished state mm-hmm. and the inescapability of their interdependence.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not explicitly... The lines to poverty aren't explicitly drawn. But
right.
I really think that statement is being made.
Yeah. Do we have any symbols here?
I don't know.
The fireplace poker.
I was going to say it's the only thing that occurs to me is a possibility. A stout poker.
Let's move on to points of interest, because I just thought of a point of interest.
Okay.
When we were talking about Ireland. The scene at the beginning where Mag asks Maureen to turn on the radio, and then she says,
say the radio.
This guy is just speaking nonsense. He should be speaking English.
Right.
And then Maureen said, we're in Ireland. Why would you speak... I mean, they're obviously speaking English right. to each other, but why would you speak English in Ireland? And so you kind of have this degradation of, like, of historical Irish culture, and, like, that the people who live there don't even know Gaelic anymore, and, like, have become kind of England's poor little brother.
Mm-hmm.
So...
There is a whole lot of... English culture versus Irish culture that's built into this play,
mm-hmm.
which is just obviously such a necessary, or such a present part of their lives.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing, the other point of interest surrounding the radio, which is the dedication that Mag mm-hmm. finally receives at the very end of the play.
Yeah.
At the beginning, she's waiting on a dedication that the two other daughters are supposed to have sent to the radio, for her 70th birthday, 71st birthday?
I think we don't really know which birthday. Her birthday.
Her birthday.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the play, after the funeral, Maureen's in the house and turns on the radio, and Mag finally gets this dedication for her 71st birthday last month. And...
Right.
And she's kind of dead.
Yeah. Well, also you're kind of going, oh, okay, so the sister's did send her a dedication, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But Sarah and I were having the conversation of Maureen mentions earlier in that scene that she died at the age of 70.
Yep.
But also that the inquest took a month.
Yes.
So she could have turned 70. She would have maybe turned 71. Like
murder
right
her
after
right
her death.
Before 71 or something.
Right.
But then the stage directions actually say she's a woman in her early 70s.
That's true.
I guess that's not really like a big mystery. I just...
Well, there's a lot of people not knowing exactly what reality is in this play.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. Which leads to questions for me.
Okay.
Because I think this will fit better with what we've just been talking about. But I... When basically the last scene made me wonder exactly how much of the play had really happened.
Yeah.
Like, I briefly was wondering if any of it had happened outside of Maureen's head.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, no, she's talking with Ray about the funeral.
Mm-hmm.
So that at least must have happened, which means some of the other stuff must have happened.
Ray's
the fact,
an interesting anchor to reality.
kind of is. But that she never met Pato at the train station.
Mm-hmm.
Who left by taxi.
Right. That was a big reveal.
And she is packing to go to America to
right.
meet him.
Right.
And is shocked to discover that she didn't actually talk to him.
Right. And it's like that was such a powerful daydream for her that, like, it became reality
yeah.
for her. And so, again, it made me the last... Because I think the next to last scene that ends with the murder
mm-hmm.
could have been the end of the play.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad it wasn't.
Yeah, because...
But that last scene, I think, puts a big spin on the way you look back at what just happened.
Like, so. She entirely... Once she realized her out, that she wasn't going to get that out,
mm-hmm.
she totally broke with reality and invented it in
her own out.
Right. So, she must have been awfully believable in the inquest.
Yeah.
Which was a little bit of my question, too. I'm like, I'm pretty sure getting brained by a poker looks nothing like falling and hitting your head.
Is Maureen a sociopathic? She is pouring hot oil in her mother's hand.
Well, she is doing that and making her eat her Compline, or else she's going to pour it over her head. Which is abusive, though not quite as directly physically. So, all right. Well, that's the main question I wanted to ask, I guess.
How much is real?
Yeah, how much is real? What is real, man?
What is reality? There is no spoon.
There is no Complan.
No. No, actually, that'd be a good thing, because Complan sounds pretty
disgusting. Sounds pretty gross. Oh, yeah.
They didn't make comments on the strengths and weaknesses of the writing.
Well, it's... I mean, the reason to be possibly irritated with Martin McDonagh for reading something on structuring plays and then writing this play is because it's so brilliantly structured.
Oh, yeah. It's a classical play structure.
Yeah.
And everything pays off, but still surprises you.
That's what I was going to say, is everything's hinted at ahead of time, but is still a surprise.
Which is really freaking hard to do.
He brings in all of the issues that he needs to bring in.
Mm-hmm.
Even associates the murder weapon with murder.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I would definitely argue that there is nothing unnecessary in here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really well done. And I know this is because he's Irish, but he totally gets the Irish dialect down perfectly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's Anglo-Irish. Like, he lived in England for a while as well.
Okay.
So...
So he's probably seen both sides of that English-Irish equation then.
Yeah.
Yep. Apparently he has written some movies that are freaking awesome.
Hmm. And we've also pointed out a couple of things that we thought were important, but were not as directly stated, but were very clearly there in the background. Like, there's a lot of subtlety to the writing, too. This is one of the better written things we've read, I think.
That's why I was surprised when I read his other plays and I didn't think that... The other two in this quote unquote trilogy, and they weren't as good and subtle. I didn't think. And maybe I was missing something, but
I think this and Pillow Man are his two best.
Yeah, I mean, Beauty Queen is just so well. Wow, what the fuck am I
doing? We can speak English.
So well done, and it is his first. It is definitely his first play. Whether or not he just sat down and wrote it,
right?
I was like, you bastard, so good. So that's my verdict, is I would definitely suggest you go read this play.
Totally recommend it.
Yep, I would too. And, you know, it's also one of those things where people, like a lot of really great writers, have a lot of good stuff out there, but even the best of the best have one or two things that are clearly identifiable as better than the rest of it.
Yeah.
And I just don't think you can be 100% on all the time, right?
That's true.
Yeah. I'm not going to, like, fault him as being a bad writer.
Right. No, I mean, that's certainly not what you were implying either.
One of these playwrights, Noah Heidel, he has a couple of hits that are really good, like Mr. Marmalade, and then he just has a couple... Ooh,
right. Misses. And just when you write something as tight as this play was, I think it's really hard to recreate that, even if you're one of the... more brilliant practitioners of your art.
Yeah.
And, like, the others didn't suck, per se. Just this one was definitely noticeably better.
At least have an extra, I mean, you could have an extra scene or an extra six lines of dialogue somewhere that just, you know, that's all it takes to unbalance something a little bit sometimes.
And maybe just not as compelling of a story. Like, these people's story is so compelling.
Mm-hmm. And I do think it's harder to nail that sweet spot with a play than a novel, maybe. Because I think if you have an extra 10,000 words in a novel, that's not too much sometimes. Even if you could cut those. In a play, I think if you have an extra 2 minutes of dialogue in one scene, that can completely change the way it comes
people
out.
People go from interested to shifting in their seats board.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Like, so fast.
The drop of a hat.
In a play, it's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well... What are you reading right now?
Still on Demon Haunted World.
By Carl Sagan?
Carl Sagan.
I am like a chapter away from finishing Fraud's Myths and Mysteries.
Science books are hard, guys. We've both taken multiple episodes to read our respective science books. That's all I'm saying.
Sorry, guys. Start something new next time. Are you reading anything right now, sir?
I'm reading Tabloid Dreams and something else. I can't remember the end of the title. It's Tabloid Dreams something. And it's a book of short stories by Robert Olin Butler, and he came and read one of his short stories at our school.
Oh, cool.
And it was freaking hilarious and also, like, made my heart want to weep tears. And that is most of the things that he writes. They're all derived from tabloid headlines, so, like, jealous husband comes back as parrot, or woman turns into nymphomaniac after getting hit by car.
Okay.
And 9-year-old, world's youngest hitman, crazy things like that.
Okay.
But he takes those off-the-wall silly concepts and makes them a real compelling and sometimes shocking, sometimes heartbreaking truth.
Hmm.
Cool.
So I recommend anything by Robert Olin Butler.
All right, then.
It's a lot of work.
I guess if you want to add anything to what we said, have any questions, comments, etc., you can...
holla at us.
Yeah. Comment on the website, novelideaspodcast.com.
We're on the internet.
Send us an email, novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
You can tweet us on Tweeters, @novelideaspod.
Tweeters. You can also find us on iTunes and subscribe through there.
I for Irish this week.
iTunes. Irish tunes.
Rate and review us on Irish tunes.
You could probably also find their addresses on the internet and stalk them, but I don't recommend that.
Yeah,
because, I mean, you don't want to have to witness all of that.
So next week, we are reading...
What are we reading next week?
We're reading Speak next week.
Was it?
I think so. Uh-oh. By Laurie Hall Sanderson. I think.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
If it's not that, then what is it?
I don't know.
What were our next two? We had another one lined up, didn't we?
Oh, I don't remember.
I don't remember either. All right, then let's assume it's Speak. We did even less.
Whoops.
We did even less preparation than usual this
week. Sorry, guys.
We'll see if that's obvious or not, I guess, when we all listen to it.
Yay.
But anyway, I think that's going to do it.
Yep.
So, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Melody, cheering, I just stay willing. Swing the wheels, you can see myself was starring.